And welcome back to the Road Rash. I have a very special guest on the phone today, blues guitar legend and Blues Hall of Fame inductee, Terry Knott. Terry, welcome to the Road Rash.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be here. And how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing quite well. And how are things across the pond?
Yeah, still pretty much the same. It's we're just coming out of the back end of winter. Summer is just starting to come in, warmer days and lighter nights. So it's just perfect.
Terry, before we start getting into talking about your new CD, Blue and Blowing, why don't you share a little bit with us about your life and experiences in the blues?
Sure. Well, it's, it started off like with most people. I was a very young kid in post-war London. London obviously was very, very badly hit during the Second World War, and even when I was born in 59, and growing up as a young kid, sort of like 4 or 5 years of age, we used to play on bomb sites and that sort of stuff. And of course, you know, that sort of era post-war London, it was very doom and gloom. You know, the country was nearly bankrupt, and it was just rife for the blues, to be perfectly honest with you. And that's really where my love of music started, mainly with the Beatles. That was the first recollection I have of, you know, actually being stopped in my tracks as a very young kid hearing the Beatles on the radio. And I thought, you know, what's this? It was quite a dramatic impact on me. And then from there on, you know, I went in with my cousins and my sisters who were older than me, had such a broad record collection. And that's where I got into the blues, you know, through old 78s and Muddy Waters, Robert Johnson, then, of course, the Rolling Stones. And through the Stones, you know, I started to do what they did, started to go back and trace the roots of the blues back to Robert Johnson, Blind Lemon Jefferson and all that. And it sort of really grasped me and grabbed hold of me by the throat, really, because the music was not how I was led to believe, the doom and gloom thing. It was just sort of like a cry for help and passionate music that rung a chord with me. And that's basically where it started. And as time went on, you know, I would listen to these artists and think, you know, how do they get that sound, the twang of the guitar string? And I just had to learn to play. And I started to find my own feet musically. And I started to listen to people like Cream and Jimi Hendrix and all these, you know, forerunners of the great guitar players we have today. And I just picked up the guitar. And really just sort of kept listening to records like, most probably like yourself, trying to emulate the sound. And that's how it started for me, Mark, to be honest. And I'm still trying to learn how to play to this day.
Well, Terry, let me be one of many to say that you do quite a fine job, my friend.
You know what it's like, Mark. You never stop learning, do you? You know, I can listen to you, you know, and I think, how the hell does he do that lick? You know, it's a constant quest. And it's one of those things, and that's the beauty of it. You never stop learning, and you never stop, you know, sort of setting your sights to become even better, and that's what I love about it.
Yes, that's one of the things that I love about it as well. The fortunate thing is that there is no end to it. The more you study, the more you practice, the better you get at your instrument. And actually, I think, you know, I think a person could live 5 lifetimes. And still not be able to say that he or she knows everything there is to know about music and about playing their instrument.
It's such a beautiful thing with the likes of, you know, what you're doing, MySpace and all these great places where there's fantastic musicians and people like yourself create a sort of forum for people like me who basically would still have our trousers around our ankles looking for gigs. And the shift in music has changed so much, you know, where it used to be to get a number one single back in the 70s at the height of music sales, you know, you'd have to sell something like 1 million singles to get a number one. You can achieve that with sort of like 10 to 15,000 here in the UK now. Mm-hmm. But the shift has come over to the independents, you know, the likes of yourself and the thousands of others are great players. And it's a great place to witness these artists, people like yourself, you know, Mike Dollins, Jimmy Lloyd Ray, and Johnny Mannion, and all these guys. You know, I just sit back in awe sometimes at the quality that's out there. And of course, you know, we keep saying about mainstream. I think, to be honest with you, this shift is now where the independents is actually the mainstream, more so than, you know, the big record labels of yesteryear.
I agree. I think in the online community that the independent would definitely be considered mainstream. And the fortunate thing is that we now have the technology and the outlet, such as the internet, to promote and market ourselves without having to depend on some big record company to do it for us.
And I think it's about time. I mean, you know, you and I are sort of like of one mind with what the record companies have done to the industry. They've strangled it, and they've really shot themselves in the foot big time. And with very little start-up costs, you know, you can produce pretty good quality music, and you can distribute it all around the world, you know. But it's sort of getting yourself heard, and it's platforms like yourself on the Road Rash and through wonderful people at KCOR with Troy and Rebecca, and people like Mike Dullins. You know, Blues Guitar News, it's a huge website. People go there, and then they spring off all over the world to find these fantastic artists. And there's an abundance of it, and long may that continue. You know, it's wonderful stuff. I think it's very exciting times.
Well, Terry, tell us a little bit about some of the famous people that you know and have played with.
You know the old saying, right place, right time? Certainly true of me. I used to work in a part of London, Swiss Cottage, which is not far from Abbey Road, you know, where the Beatles, the legendary Beatles recording studio. And that little zebra crossing there, the black and white crossing, I've walked across that many times. Well, not too far from that is another recording studio. And totally unbeknownst to me, my boss at the time said, we're going out on the town one night. And I said, yeah, sure, where are we going? Because I was commuting then back from London to Southampton. And it can be about a 2 or 3 hour drive, so it's not something you want to do after a night on the town, you know. And he said, well, don't worry. He said, we'll stay over. So I said, okay. So anyway, to cut a very long story short, we ended up outside this recording studio, which actually I think mimicked the name of Elvis Presley's original recording studio, Sun Studios. But you couldn't tell it. There was no signs on it to denote what it was, but there was a huge brick wall at the front with gates, and these two sort of like gorillas at the gate who happened to turn out to be very nice chaps. And we walked through the gate and they were checking us off. They asked for my name and I gave them my name with my boss. And we walked into this studio and walked through the corridor. And we were checked in by a woman and she was asked our name. She gave us a pack. And what it actually was, it was Gibson Guitars doing a tribute to Scotty Moore. For his lifelong contribution to music, and of course him playing predominantly Gibson guitars. So anyway, we carried on walking through, actually into the recording studio part of it, and I was just, you know, like a kid in a candy store, basically. I just stood at the entrance as I walked in, and there they were, all my boyhood heroes, just standing there. And it was a case of pinching myself to realise what I was actually, you know, standing looking at, from Jimmy Page through to Gary Moore, DJ Font. Well, actually, I've got to tell you something, tell you the truth here. I'd heard of DJ Fontana and I'd heard of Scotty Moore, but I couldn't recall their faces. If I did have a memory of them, it was on the old record sleeves, you know, back in the, you know, 55 and all that sort of stuff. But of course, they were sort of old chaps by this time, and I was standing there, and these two old guys come up to me and just started talking very, very nicely, you know, really nice men, and I realised who they were, and they were Scotty Moore and DJ Fontana, and basically the evening sort of developed from there, and the next thing I know, you know, I'm standing talking to Gary Moore, and we were talking just generally about music, and I happened to turn to my left, and one of my personal heroes was Jack Bruce, came walking across the floor from Cream, and Cream was a huge influence on me, so I thought, I've just got to go up and talk to this guy, and the irony about it was, we both smoke, and we were smoking the same sort of hand-rolling tobacco, and that created a bit of a joke between the two of us, And that's how it went on. And I was standing there talking for some time, and the next thing we know, you know, everyone's jamming, including myself, to Elvis numbers all night. And it was actually on VH1, but they never showed the whole thing. It was just sort of like sound bites and clips of what went on. But it was a truly humbling evening, because there I was with all these guitar legends, and each one of them treated me with so much respect and support. And I came away, you know, feeling quite honored to have experienced that. And it's certainly something you never forget.
Well, that's for sure. I would love to be able to meet and jam with Gary Moore. He has always been one of my favorite blues and blues rock guitarists.
Yeah, the thing that struck me with him, and the irony was, he's a wonderful guitar player. He really is. I mean, there's no two ways about it, but he's not somebody that I've always leaned to. I would listen to him and enjoy him, but he wasn't somebody I would naturally lean to. But how this happened with him, my boss, who arranged all this for me, I may hasten to add, he did a wonderful job. He knew a mutual friend of Gary Moore, and that's who got the intro. And the man was just a lovely human being. He really was. And we sat there, or stood there, talking over a few beers for a good three quarters of an hour. And it was quite funny. When we went to play, they had a host of Gibson guitars there, Les Pauls, obviously, which Gary Moore predominantly plays. And I picked up 335 and plugged it into the amplifier, because there was no effects pedal there. The amplifiers didn't have much distortion on them or drive. And it actually sounded like a wet fart, you know? And Gary Moore looked as much as say, well, how am I going to get this to sing? And of course he couldn't, to the sort of levels he was used to. And that sort of semi-tripped everybody up. But he was fantastic. You could see he was a natural. And he just went for it with Jack Bruce. And it was really Scotty Moore watching him who had influenced all these guitar players. And it was just wonderful to see all the generations that had been influenced by, you know, there was sort of me, the third generation, looking up to the likes of Jimmy Page, who I stood talking to, and then above him was his inspiration being Scotty Moore, etc. So it was just a beautiful thing to see, like, three generations of musicians that, you know, one had inspired the other and so on down the line. And it's, of course, that's how music goes. And it was just a beautiful thing. But Gary Moore, yeah, he's a wonderful man, and he's a first-rate guitarist. But then, Mark, you're not so shabby yourself, are you?
Well, thanks a lot, Terry. I appreciate that. Let's talk a little bit about your new CD, Blue Wind Blowing. What was the inspiration for this album?
Well, to be honest with you, it wasn't no sort of Sergeant Pepper moment, that's for sure. It sort of just happened. I mean, I had, like most people, I got myself a little recording deck and just started sort of playing, really, and just sort of getting used to the recording process. And I guess I'd put, I don't know, about sort of 30 or 40 numbers together. But I was really struggling to sort of get a sound quality in the production process, primarily, that I was happy with, because you know yourself. You know, when you listen to a studio album, that's what you have to aspire to, those sort of, you know, clear qualities. And I just wasn't getting it. But then all of a sudden, things started to improve pretty rapid when I got a handle on it. And I had this sort of like mass of songs. And at about that time, and I can't quite remember how it happened. I think it was Mike, I think, Mike Dollins, bless him, who said, why don't you come over to MySpace? Well, I'd never heard of it. And I said, well, okay, what's all that about? And he went on to explain. So I popped across to MySpace and sort of like set things up on there. And then I pretty quickly, through Mike and yourself around about that time, I sort of like had this host of like people guiding me on what could be done. And then sort of it was asked of me pretty rapid to get an album going. So I was, tracks that I thought, you know, I mean, you know what it's like as a musician. You're never 100% satisfied with what you do. But I had a sort of 12 tracks that I thought, well, yeah, that could make it, and that would be okay for my first attempt. So I quite quickly picked out 12 tracks and sort of put it together and got the process underway. And I thought, well, what do I call it? You know, it, as I say, it wasn't, certainly wasn't a Sergeant Pepper moment. And this particular day, I went out for a walk, and it was absolutely bloody freezing, you know, ice cold wind, you know, eyebrows freezing up as you walk down the road, usual story. And it was the wind that actually made me think of the name. And I thought, well, blue wind blowing, bonk, that'll do. And that's really the sum total of how it started. But, you know, I look back on it, and it's like everything else. It was a pivotal moment for me, and it's done well for itself, far better than I ever thought it would do. And I'm quietly pleased with it. But the next one is well, it's not, I can't say it's nearly complete, but I've got a good 8 or 9 songs, of which a lot I've written myself this time, whereas I think about 4 or 5 on the other album I did. So I want that to come out and be absolutely as perfect as I can get it. So I'm hoping by sort of mid to late summer that will be completed.
Well, one of the many things that I really enjoyed about the CD was the fact that you have a very live, raw sound on this CD, which I felt really fit the songs, it fit your playing, and it fit your voice. And listening to these tunes as many times as I have, I really feel that the live, raw sound was the way to go on this, and you did a great job on it.
Yeah, I think, to be honest with you, although at the time I never consciously went in to achieve that, it was sort of when I got to the sort of the feel that I thought, yeah, I like that, I actually was at a gig. You know, some gigs you can record it and then, like, play it back. And I found myself listening to a recording of me playing live, and it was very much like the album, and it was really where I wanted to be. And I remember actually talking to Les, bless his heart, and he said exactly what you just said about the live feel. And I said, I try to go into it sort of fresh, and I never, ever have done more than 2 takes on anything. So mistakes and all, if they're severe enough, I'll take them out, of course. But invariably, I won't go above 2 takes, because for me personally, if I don't do it in 2 takes, my sort of, not energy, but my passion for what I'm playing at that moment in time starts to dwindle, do you know?
Sure.
I find unless I can capture what I'm playing within 2 takes, then whatever I play subsequently after that doesn't have the feel that I'm looking for. But I started to get that sort of live feel, and I'm continuing with that vein. There are some tracks that actually were not on the CD that are quite studio based, particularly instrumentals, which I did with my late friend Big Pete Gale, who he and I go back to when we were kids. We had our first band together in sort of like 74, and he was very much into big productions, and he influenced the production on that. Although I wrote the songs and we recorded them together, he said, let's try and give it a real big sound. And I managed to achieve that also, but that wasn't my sort of natural leaning to do that, because I like the rawness of, and that's why I love the old Delta Blues stuff, Mark. You know, I listen to Robert Johnson, and he makes me shiver just by listening to that raw, clean, you know, I know it's a primitive sound that he had back then, but there's something about it that compels me. And I try and keep as close to that as I possibly can. And it seems to work, fortunately.
Well, Terry, I've heard quite a few independent groups over the years that have tried to pull off that live sound in the studio. And some of them, to me, just sounded like they had used a cheap recorder in somebody's garage somewhere. And it just didn't sound very well. But you definitely did a great job at pulling off the live sound for Blue Wind Blowing. And
thank you, Mark. And the $20 is in the post.
Huh?
I said, thank you, Mark, for the compliment. The $20 are in the post.
Well,
I appreciate it, Mark.
Well, just make sure that's in cash.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no checks. They won't bounce. Thank you. No, that's very kind of you, Mark. You know, I, I don't take compliments very well, you know. It's I'm sure like yourself, I just do what I do to the best of my ability. And it's people like yourself and the other guys that I mention that really do actually inspire me, you know. I will listen to yourself. I mean, you know, you talk about a sound that you particularly get. And I listen to yourself, and you just get such that, how can I don't know what the terminology is, but you get that sort of large hall sound where your guitar sort of emanates and bounces off the walls. Like One Drink Away from the Blues, the actual album title song, I think that is just a superb track. And that feel for that, the sort of energy that comes off it, I think he's just first class, and that's the sort of thing that inspires me to sort of like dabble in the production process, not try and move too far away from where I am, but just try other things, you know. It's like you get that eureka moment, and listening to you guys, it's an amazing inspiration, it really is.
Well, thanks a lot, Terry. Let's take a quick listen to one of your tunes off of your CD, Blue Wind Blowing. Did you have one in mind?
Well, you're the host. I'll let you choose. Whatever you like.
Okay, well, here's Terry Knott with Hurts Me Too off of his CD, Blue Wind Blowing.
You were hurt.
that was Terry Nod with Hurts Me Too off of his CD, Blue Wind Blowing. Terry, where can the Road Rash listeners pick up a copy of your CD?
Well, it's at CD Baby. I most probably will change from that for the next album. But the best thing to do will be to go to my website and pick up the link from there, which is www.myspace.com/BritPatBlues. And then they'll see that the logo for the album via iTunes or through CD Baby, etc., on the left-hand side of the page.
Terry, how would you say that your digital download sales stack up against your hard copy sales?
Actually, I would say that the download sales via iTunes, you know, you sell through CD Baby, you get sort of like reports on your digital distribution. Well, that sort of went pretty wild. But you haven't got any trace back, you know, unlike CD Baby, when the hard copy's sold, you get who bought it and where they're from and everything else. And the huge concentration of the hard copy sales have actually been in Texas, surprisingly enough. I would say 65% of my total sales have been in Texas. But in terms of distribution via Apple and the various other ones that there, what I can trace back of it and the comments I've had through my site is mainly Japan. And I must say, Texas Jake Lee advised me about Japan. It's such a big, you know, huge blues-loving country. And he, you know, he's a great lad, Jake, and he was dead right. And Japan has been a huge source of sales, particularly via iTunes, in that area. So that's been very, very pleasing.
Right. And the reason I ask that is because my digital download sales blow my hard copy sales out of the water.
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, I can't remember the actual statistics, but in terms of revenue, I would say, comparing the two, it's got to be sort of like an 80-20 sort of percentage split in favour of downloads. And it's a wonderful thing. That the sad part about that is, and that's why I'm a huge fan of MySpace, because you can be interactive with the people who buy your music. And I don't like the term fan, you know, and I do mean it in the nicest possible way. So you can interact with them and you can sort of like get a feeling of actually how they feel about what they've heard. But with the downloads, of course, all I can tend to find is where they picked up the link to Apple iTunes. And of course, if it says Google, then it shows where they actually picked that up from, and it predominantly seems to be Japan. But, you know, downloads, it's a huge thing. You know, I know people in this country who love your shows, you know, all your rock shows, your country show, your rock show, Blues Nation, and, of course, this one. And you know, some of these media centres you have now where you can plug in your iPod and you can listen to the Blues Nation, you know, about 5 weeks downloads, you've got a sort of a wonderful night full of entertainment. And it's just superb stuff. And I never really grasped the download thing because of sort of like my age. I'm sort of like knocking on 50 this year. And I struggled when it went from vinyl to CD. I used to think, what the bloody hell's this, you know? So I sort of changed over to the CD. I sort of like dragged away from the vinyl over to the CD, and I sort of just grasped that. And now you've got sort of like the iPod and docking station into these wonderful sounding systems. And I've sort of now really grasped that and embraced it. And that's where I get a lot of my music now. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, you know, I heard a couple of weeks ago from a musician friend of mine that the industry was actually talking about putting vinyl back into the marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, like the modern music, you know, this dance crap. I mean, I've never been a lover for it. You know, it's just sort of like one bass beat and a load of thumping drums. But you go to nightclubs, what are the DJs playing? It's vinyl. You know, they're squeaking the table around and giving it all that, you know, funny sounding, like reverse round the needle. But the sound, I mean, I tell you what, I listened the other day on vinyl, well, say the other day, it was quite some time ago, my brother-in-law, Ron, he is a huge music fan and an eclectic taste you would not believe. He's got albums from Sinatra all the way through to Muddy Waters, you know, and we were sitting around his house not too long ago, and he said, I'm going to play you something. And he went in, and he's got this big, beautiful chest that he opened up, and it's just full of his old vinyl and my sister's old stuff. And he brought out the old 5x4 Rolling Stones album from 1964, and he put it on pretty much a state-of-the-art music centre that still had a turntable on it. And do you know what, Mark? We had the same copy on CD, but the sound that come out of the vinyl just had so much atmosphere. It was sort of like that unique sound that I don't think... there was a lot to do with the production process, I know, but the actual sound and atmosphere that come from the vinyl was just mind-blowingly different.
Well, as you remember, recordings on vinyl were analog recordings, and that's one of the things that I enjoy so much about going back and listening to the vinyl of yesteryear, is the fact that they were analog, because the analog sound was just so hot and upfront, or what some people would refer to as an in-your-face kind of sound. And that's something you just do not get from today's digital recording, and I miss that, I really do.
I remember, obviously I'm a few years older than yourself, but going back to when I was like really the music hit me, my sister and my cousins and all that really were the influences on me in terms of their record collections. Even at a very young age of 4 to 5, I remember listening to Pet Sounds, you know, the Beach Boys?
Right.
And that was put on the record player. And we had, I don't know what you call them in the States, but they were like Dan sets, we used to call them. Just those mono, one speaker at the front, you flip the lid, you got the hook at the top where you pull it over, pull it back, put the record on, put the lever back on, press a button at the side, select your speed, the record would drop, and the arm would come across as slow as a snail, rest down, you'd hear that crackling, and then the sound would hit you. And the Beach Boys, which again was another huge influence on me, was the sound that they got in their production process, and the structure of Brian Wilson's music just blew me away. Now, I think that set the pace for even the Beatles, and that's been well documented. You know, I mean, Paul McCartney said it was, Pet Sounds that influenced Sergeant Pepper, but Brian Wilson also said that it was Rubber Soul that influenced Pet Sounds. So there was sort of like a friendly rivalry going on there, and that sort of set the pace for the likes of 10 years later when Dark Side of the Moon came out and that sort of stuff. That were these huge productions. But then you go back, as I said originally, to like listening to Robert Johnson. And when I hear him kick off, my mind just goes back to just sitting with him, watching him play in some little booth where he recorded, some of it he recorded in Texas. And it just takes me back. You know, it's a time and places thing. But it's the emotion that the sound generates that captivates me. And I think it's beautiful. The only thing with vinyl, of course, is it does wear. And as it does wear, of course, the sound, not the sound of the music comes out, but you do tend to get sort of like the crackle and the hissing. But perhaps that's part of its beauty. I don't know.
Well, Terry, are you doing any touring at the moment?
No, I'm sort of taking a bit of a break now. I've got quite a few other projects on. And I will be trying to concentrate on getting the album done. But I don't want to do it sort of waiting for the last moment and pushing it out. I'm taking my time to do it this time, whereas before it was sort of like a bit of a rush situation. But there's a few gigs coming up. I mean, I'm mainly now sort of like guest with bands because it's easier to do and it's more fun for me. But I am actually thinking and hoping that perhaps in a couple of years A friend of mine, Mick Rutherford, lives up the north of England. Perhaps that one day we'll come over and play a few gigs in the States, which hopefully may coincide with the Blues Hall of Fame venture in Clarksdale. So that will be a wonderful thing. And, of course, it would be great to see you there too.
Yes, that would be great, Terry. It sure would. Well, listen, do you have, let's say an educated guess as to when your second CD is going to be available on the market?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, in all honesty, Mark, I would say most probably about August time. I've got, as I say, I've got a good 8 tracks now. This one I want to give value for money and sort of like have a 15 tracker ready. I want to steer away as best as I can from cover versions and make the whole album, by perhaps the odd one or two, my own stuff. And I've got quite a bank of original stuff that I've sort of sketched out and done sketch tracks for. I just need to build on them. I'm starting now to get a handle on, and it's taken me a long time to do that, where my voice can go and where it can't go. I mean, you know, singing is not what I naturally do. And I have to get that right to get the best out of my voice. So that's what I'm going to focus on. So I'm trying to give myself some vocaling coaching as I go along. But, yeah, I would say about August time, Mark.
Well, great.
And how's your one coming on, by the way?
Well, it's coming along pretty good. I've got 2 songs left to go, and the CD will be finished. But the making of this CD has been a very long, arduous process. It really has. And I've had several obstacles and hurdles to get over, if you will, that's kind of slowed down the producing of this CD. But hopefully I will have the stamina to be able to market this CD that I had during the release of the first one. Of course, as you well know, you've got to put forth a tremendous amount of time marketing a CD as an independent, because most of us do not have a staff. And we're working on a very small budget, but I just hope that this CD opens up as many doors for me and opportunities as what the first one did. But I'm hoping to have this one ready for release around end of May, 1st of June.
You've got a great head on your shoulders. You've got a great following. You know how to market yourself, and you do it great. And to be honest with you, Mark, you don't really need much marketing. You just put the CD on the player or download the tune, and the music speaks for itself. And I think your album's going to be a success. I mean, you can take that as read.
Well, thanks a lot, Terry. I really appreciate those kind words. I really do. Well, let's pop a couple of quarters in the jukebox and pull up another one off of Blue Wind Blowing. How about one of my favorites, Long Time Ago?
Yeah, fine. Yeah, that's... I quite like that one, too. That was... I actually did that for my late friend, Pete, who died just a few months ago. Him and I were sort of like great friendly rivals, and he was, and you know, you've heard him yourself, he was a wonderful fluid guitar player.
Yes, he was.
Actually, he was a huge fan of yours too, I must say that, and likewise with Gary Moore. And he was such a fluid player, and he said to me, why don't you try and use a bit more wah-wah? And to be honest with you, up until that track, I've never really used it much, for no real reason. And then I thought, well, okay, I'll give it a go. And I really enjoyed playing with it, and it sort of like gave it quite a sound. And I must say, you can hide a lot behind wah-wah, as you know, but still get a really funky sound coming out of it. And so I recorded that, and then I went on to do, fun enough, which is not on the album, to do Voodoo Child. And I must say that Voodoo Child was most probably, in my personal, my favourite song that I've ever done, to be honest. So that was a bit of information on a long time ago.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that one myself when you sent it to me to play on the shows. I thought you did a very, very good job on that.
Thank you, Mark. I mean, Hendrix, you know, we talk of, there's so many guitar players that were a huge inspiration to me, but I mean, you know, Clapton was, but Hendrix, I mean, he just sort of lifted the crossbar up, didn't he? He set it up, and really so much what we do today is sort of like based around his style. And I often sit and wonder, you know, if he was around today, where he would be at musically?
Well, I would say that he would be probably two or three times the guitar player that he was in the 60s.
Oh, he would. It was funny. It was about a year ago, myself and my wife were watching the Isle of Wight, one of his last concerts, mm-hmm. because, as you know, he lived over here for many years when it was all happening in the 60s. And they played that on the TV, and I was sitting there watching it, and I just happened to look across to my other half, and I said, Craig, I said, he was an amazing guitar player. And she just sort of like threw this throwaway comment at me. She went, yes, he was. And I didn't think about it. The show carried on. I was watching it. I thought, that was a strange reply. And I looked at her. I said, what do you mean, yes, he was? And my wife was actually there in 1970 as a 10-year-old with her aunt watching Jimi Hendrix on stage.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So I've never spoken to her since.
Well, that sounds like grounds for divorce. Well, Terry, what song did I say I was going to play?
You said Long Time Ago.
Okay, here's Terry Knott with Long Time Ago off of his brand new CD, Blue Wind Blowing. For those of you just joining us, that was Terry Knott, a long time ago, off of his brand new CD, Blue Wind Blowing. Terry, you want to tell the Road Rash audience one more time where they can pick up your CD?
Sure, Mark. The best thing will be to go to my website, which is www.myspace.com/BritPackBlues, and they will find all they need to know on that page.
Well, Terry, I can't begin to tell you enough what a real honor and pleasure that it has been having you on the Road Rash and speaking with you today.
Thank you, Mark.
And you're a good man, my friend, and I wish that the world had about a million more just like you. It would definitely be a much better place.
Thank you, Mark.
And I have certainly enjoyed your CD, and you are what I would call a real deal blues man. And I think that everyone in the UK and the US should own a copy of Blue Wind Blowing, don't you?
Thank you. Well, that would be very nice, Mike. and perhaps on the new one, on the new CD cover, I can have a picture with my new dress on.
Okay. Well, if that be the case, then I would say you will sell probably 1 or 2 million copies in San Francisco alone. And they may even erect a statue of you out there. No pun intended, of course.
Yeah, yeah, it'd be great. I've always felt a bit light on my feet, but honestly, this is just a joke.
Well, Terry, once again, it's been a real pleasure. And be sure to let me know when you've got your second CD out, and we'll get you back on.
Thank you, Mark.
Terry, take care, my friend.
You take care, buddy, and look after yourself.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you, Mark. Bye.